designed specifically for Kegel mastery, like Betty Dodson's Kegel Sizer. They can be done solo, and that is usually a good place to start, but can also be done during penetrative intercourse, which can be a lot of fun for both partners. Locate the muscle group in question by squeezing the muscles you use to stop your urine flow. If you are urinating and are able to halt the flow, you have the right muscle group. Your stomach and buttocks muscles should not tighten in the process. You also don't want to do your Kegel exercises when emptying your bladder on a regular basis. That can lead to weakening the pelvic floor muscles, which can prevent you from fully emptying your bladder, which, in turn, can lead to an increase in urinary tract infections. Once you have located the right muscle group, practice your Kegels regularly. If you are using a Kegel aid, lubricate the aid before insertion and practice Kegels lying down. If you are not using an aid, it may be of benefit to at first practice lying down. Squeeze that muscle group for 3 seconds, then release for 3 seconds. Complete 10 to 15 cycles of squeeze and release. Try to do this at least 3 times a day. The more regularly you perform the exercise, the better results you will get, just like any exercise. As you get more comfortable doing this, you will find that you don't have to set aside Kegel time to be effective. You can do them while engaging in other activities, since no one will know what you are up to. Unless, of course, you are doing them during sex, in which case your partner will know and appreciate. Questions for reflection. After trying Kegel exercises for a period of time, what difference have you noticed in your sex life? Has it benefited you, your partner? Have you noticed any other differences in your health in regard to urinary flow, general pelvic comfort? Conclusion for part 2. This whole section is very focused on your own experience of your body. Super weird in a book about relationships with others, right? Why don't we just move on to the partner stuff for fuck's sake? Except starting with our relationship to our own bodies is an essential starting place. How can we know who we are in relation to others if we have no idea what's going on in our own bodies? It's entirely okay and really very normal if everything you listen to in this section is super new to you. Or it's stuff you've tried but felt like you failed at accomplishing. You may be fighting years of conditioning around sexual expression, and that may take a while. Keep fighting for yourself. You have every right to be empowered, comfortable in your skin, and deeply satisfied with yourself. Part 3. Unfuck your relationship with others. My therapeutic training is grounded in relational cultural theory. One of the biggest differences between this treatment orientation and others is that we regard relationships as their own entity, meaning that in every connection we have with someone else, there is us, there is them, and there is the relationship itself as its own third party. This perspective is a bit of sorcery that can have an amazing impact on your romantic partnership. So, if part 2 of this book is the you part, then this part is relationship itself part. And since you're a smart motherfucker, you notice that I didn't include a them section. Because someone else is not your job, right? You are responsible for you. And you have a joint responsibility to the relationship. So we are focusing on you in relation here, not them. That's their job. So this section includes far fewer naked shenanigans than you might expect, because even if you are an exceptional specimen, only a small percentage of your time is actually spent on aforementioned naked shenanigans. And all this other self-in-relationship stuff is the basis for making that part far better. Intimacy and dating. Dating. Whatever happened to dating? Wooing, courting, shaking your plumage and doing the mating dance. There seems to be zero space between hooking up and friends with benefits and having the U-Haul number on speed dial. Either we make the beast with two backs and then take off, or we move in and adopt a dog together in 3 minutes flat. Let's be honest. Neither one is an authentic response. If sex without feelings has become your long-term solution, then you've fallen into the "it's cooler not to care" trap. It's safer there. You don't get hurt if it wasn't emotional to begin with. But belly flopping into something time after time isn't the more mature response. Then it becomes about being in a relationship, rather than being with a particular person with whom you want to build a relationship. Desperate to connect is just as toxic in the end as desperate to stay disconnected. Fuck. It's all pretty bonkers. And no wonder the idea of dating has got everyone all up in a tizzy. The amount of time I have spent with clients and friends discussing the merits of different dating apps, local bars and hangouts, and other minutiae of the dating scene is not a small number. Everything is a question. When do I start opening up about the heavy stuff? What's considered heavy stuff? When is too soon? When is too late? Why am I always friend-zoned? No wonder we end up saying, "fuck that noise," and settle in for another round of Candy Crush instead. Or end up spending years with someone who is not right for us, making each other miserable. Because someone is better than no one, right? Dating becomes an obstacle course instead of what it is supposed to be, which is something fun. Are you in that space? Early stage, almost relationshipping? Considering the FTR, friends to relationship if you aren't fluent in acronym, move? Dating? Thinking about dating? Opening up the OKCupid website, then feeling nauseous and closing the browser window immediately? Stressful as balls, isn't it? I don't know about you, but I'm so over it. It's time for us to reclaim this space from the asshole culture around us. Roll up your sleeves, my blueberry muffins. Let's get to work. How to find a date. It used to be we met the people we dated at school or church, or because our parents arranged shit down to the number of goats everyone got out of the deal. Then the internet happened and shit changed, and generally for the better. Online chat rooms turned into IRL relationships, and by 1995, the first official dating website, Match.com if you're interested, went live. Instead of being limited to only one degree or two from Kevin Bacon, the whole world opened up and we connected with people completely outside our small social circles. Researchers from the University of Essex and University of Vienna were able to model the changes created by the advent of online dating. The number of interracial marriages has gone up significantly, and the marriages that were born of meeting online are often stronger than those of people who meet in more traditional ways. Currently, more than a third of marriages start online. It's the second most likely way someone who is heterosexual will find a partner, and it is far and away the most likely place for someone who is LGBT to find someone to date. That's not to say it's all well and good. Online dating can suck balls too. The advent of swipe apps, starting with Tinder in 2012, have made the process more game-like. You're essentially flipping through a card deck, creating accept and reject piles. And the process has fucked with a lot of people's self-esteem. Research presented at the American Psychological Association conference in 2012 demonstrated that people who used Tinder as a dating app had worse self-esteem than people who used other dating apps. Going back to why self-compassion is so important, am I right? And men specifically reported more negative body image perceptions than their counterparts on other sites. So, what's a modern human looking to find someone to do? If you are using a dating site, choose carefully. Think about your end goals. Marriage and all the baby raising? Netflix and chill? And pick a site that matches. Also, be honest about your end goals. Don't say you were good with keeping things casual when your reality is ticking biological clock. And if you aren't sure, say that too. Maybe you were open to an LTR, but that's not what you're going in with as an endgame. If people self-select out, then fine. That wasn't meant to be your person anyway. Be honest about all of it. Don't lie about your age, your weight, your circumstances. Seriously, stop with the Snap Filter enhanced photos and the artful hand under the chin tuck. Look your best, but look yourself and be yourself. Separated but not yet divorced? Own it. Have 4 kids? Own it. Because again, if people self-select out, then fine. They weren't meant to be your person anyway. If online isn't your cup of tea, then you are going to have to put yourself out there in other ways. Awkward and vulnerable, but far better than staying home and playing video games all weekend if what you actually want to do is meet someone. So you are going to have to expand your social circle. Find people who are doing the interesting shit that you like to do. If tabletop gaming is your thing, join a meetup for gamers rather than just hang out with your same crew all the time. If you're a jogger, join a running group. If you like movies and popcorn, there are totally meetups just for people to get together to go to the movies as a group. You may not meet the love of your life, but at least you are doing something you enjoy and getting out of your regular circle. And maybe one of those people will end up introducing you to the love of your life at some point. Volunteer. If you are passionate about animal rescue or electing a particular candidate to office or anything else, then volunteer to help make that happen. Just like with the previously mentioned, at least you aren't doing something that feels like a waste of time otherwise. Fruitlessly hanging out at a bar, anyone? You will expand your social network, and you are racking up some bonus world-changing points in the process. Ask people who they know. Yeah, awkward. But if you want to go out with someone, you gotta meet them first. You don't have to look for the Carrie Fisher in When Harry Met Sally friend that has a dude Rolodex or anything, but just put it out there that you have an eye out, what you're looking for, and you are amenable to an intro. My adolescence was pre-social media. Xer babies represent. I dated a guy as a sophomore from another school who I met through a friend from my school who was dating his bestie. She showed him my picture. He said, intrigued, and met me at a school dance they were both attending. Wouldn't have met him if it hadn't been for my girl hustling on my behalf. Come to think of it, school photos being passed around was essentially a low-tech Tinder, am I right? And lest we forget, Carrie Fisher's character ended up marrying Bruno Kirby's character, and they met through Harry and Sally. Be prepared to approach in a way that is engaging but still authentic. Don't be the person in the coffee shop that interrupts someone who is reading or has headphones in, but if they're standing in line to order and are holding a book, maybe try, "I keep seeing that book around," or "I've never seen that book around," whatever works. Any good? As an opening line. You need a cold open? I have a friend who is not super hot but has great game because he first approaches with, "Are you waiting on anyone?" And if they say no or say yes, but indicate it's a friend and not a date, he follows up with, "Is it cool if I flirt with you for a little while then?" If you don't have the Sergeant Smooth gene, embrace your discomfort. The right person will think that's pretty cute. Maybe, "I'm gonna kick myself later if I didn't at least come up and introduce myself. And I'm feeling super awkward, so here's hoping I don't embarrass myself so badly that I will feel the urge to go walk into traffic. Hi, I'm..." Make it your mission to start conversations with people in general, and approaching someone you think is super cute will seem less intimidating. So go practice. Okay, so you met someone. The best dating advice I've got for you? Date like a therapist. I married early in my adult life, while others my age were still dating. Then, in my late 30s, my husband died of cancer. Suddenly, I was a young widow with 2 teenagers and a complicated career. The dating world had become a very different world since my years as a teenager. By the time I was ready to date, I wasn't sure what awaited me. My specialty in private practice is intimacy and relationships. Would that complicate matters? Would I overanalyze everything and scare my dates away? Instead, I found that the same qualities that made me a good therapist were of great benefit to dating. I was no longer in my early 20s, but neither were the men I met. Maturity was part of it, but an even more important factor was my therapeutic training. I didn't need to turn that part of myself off to enter the dating world. Instead, I found it to be very useful to my dating experiences. Eventually, I got married again, something I had no expectation of ever happening. I truly believe that dating like a therapist helped me find the man I am completely crazy about, and I wanted to share the benefit of these experiences with others in the dating market. I'd like to share some insights with you and save you the years of graduate school and student loan debt that it took for me to figure it out. Be present, be engaged, be authentic. Most individuals give off certain signals demonstrating interest and availability in a dating environment. I was told by more than one person that I didn't engage in any of them. I didn't twirl my hair, giggle, or make extraneous physical contact on dates. One guy told me that at first he didn't know how to respond to me. He was used to gauging if someone was interested in him by reading these signals, but then he realized that he felt completely comfortable with me because I was focusing all my attention on him. If I committed to a date with someone, even a meeting for coffee, I was committing my time and attention to that person. Everyone deserves the respect of an engaged and present response. My intent is to get to know the person, not put on a show for them. If someone comes to see me for therapy, they receive my undivided attention, whether I find them interesting or likable. Dating someone should be the same. If I was too busy sending out flirty signals, I would miss getting to know someone in a truly authentic way. Use SMART goal setting. When writing a treatment plan for a client, I ask the following questions to help formulate goals. Is the goal specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time-sensitive? Dating should be no different. What do you want from your dating experience? How will you know if you are getting that? If you are looking for a life partner, how will you know if you are on that path? If you are looking for someone to have fun with, what does fun look like for you? Don't waste your time or theirs. Know what you want and how you plan on getting there. Consider where you are now and pay attention to any signals that suggest that your goals are changing. Not that wandering aimlessly is always a bad thing, but you are far more likely to get what you want if you know what that actually is. Not all agendas are explicit. Hidden agendas may not have anything to do with you. I expect people to be guarded starting out in therapy, and I tell them that I not only expect that, I respect it. If anything, dating is even more anxiety-provoking than starting therapy. The word agenda seems like a sinister one, I know. But in reality, it just refers to the motivations and intentions that we all carry into everything we do, including into our dating lives. Much like someone walking into a therapist's office, anyone you are dating has their own agenda for their dating experience, an agenda that may or may not be congruent with your own. They may not even be fully aware of what they want. Their motivations are not nearly as personal as you think it is. Relationship building takes time, so give it space to grow. Don't take everything personally. Be willing to explore rather than make immediate demands on it. Be aware of your countertransference. Countertransference is a therapeutic word first coined by Freud in correspondence with Jung in 1909. He defined it as the therapist's emotional response to their client based on their own history or issues. Freud conceived this as a personal problem on the part of the therapist and something that should be guarded against and tamped down at all times. More than 100 years later, we think about countertransference much differently. I teach my students that countertransference is entirely normal and can be beneficial, as well as diagnostic, as long as we remain aware of it when it happens. This means parsing out whether other people have a similar response to this person or just you. Essentially, the question becomes, when you have a strong emotional reaction to someone, is it your stuff or theirs? This is no different when dating someone new. If their behavior is upsetting or anxiety-provoking in any way, listen for cues that other people have the same response to that person. This can lend insight into how they interact with others in general and help you decide whether or not this is a behavior you want to endure. If it seems to be just your response, then it is important that you do your own work around that, rather than expecting someone else to adapt to your triggers. Chances are, this will be something that will come up for you over and over again, even if you don't end up with this particular person, so you might as well do the work. We all have our own baggage and relationships, but it is important that we take responsibility for carrying it. Know when to terminate. Firing clients is a tough thing for a therapist to do. We struggle with knowing when it is appropriate and how to do so in the best possible way. This is where the SMART goal setting comes in. Are we progressing along the lines that we should be? Are we progressing at all? Is the agenda becoming more explicit? Can I adapt to the agenda and needs of the person I am seeing? Is the client showing up when they are supposed to and doing the things they said they are going to do? Can you think of any better analogy to a breakup? I might be biased, but I never could. The poet Maya Angelou was known for saying, "When someone shows you who they are, believe them." I tell clients all the time that in the end, love is a behavior. Do you feel respected? Is your time valued? Do you feel the relationship is moving forward? If not, have you addressed these issues and asked for change? I have told clients, "I don't think this is helping you, and it is important that I don't waste your time. We either need to find a way to make this work, or I can refer you to someone else." I have had similar conversations with people I have dated. Termination doesn't mean someone is a bad person. It means you are ending a bad match. In the end, all of us deserve relationships that let us be our best possible selves and support us in that endeavor. We need to know what we want and give our relationships a chance to meet these desires. We also need to know when to let them go or change the nature of them to better meet our needs. Therapy, in the end, should model what a healthy relationship can be like. A therapeutic approach to dating can be a very effective strategy for creating the types of relationships we are seeking. It isn't your typical smoke and mirrors dating advice. Instead of hiding who you are, I suggest you be exactly who you are, because that is the person you want others to see and know. More dating tips for grown-ass people. The chapter preceding this one was originally published by a local news organization, the Rivard Report in San Antonio, Texas, if you're curious, and it was a hit. One of my bonus kiddos ended up getting it as a reading assignment in one of her classes at the local community college, which cracked her up mightily. In the ensuing years, I've added other dating tips to the list based on the patterns I see happening with my clients, with my single friends, and even based on the what the fucks I think when reading shit online. So here's some more taking the crazy out of dating advice. Have fun. Yes, seriously. The fun part? That's the number one priority. That doesn't mean don't be nervous. Because, duh, you likely will be. But at some point, you should be relaxing a bit and having a blast. If you do an internal fun check and you aren't thinking, "I'm digging this person, woohoo!" then nothing is there for you. That's okay. A date is just a date. If you aren't busy picking out the names for your future children in your head, you can actually have fun. And if you don't, it was just a date. Far less serious and heart-wrenching if it ends with just that. Do a deep down gut check. Does something feel off? Unsafe? Listen to that. Listen hard. If your intuition tells you that something is fundamentally wrong at any point, don't ignore it. This is so difficult for people who have spent their lives being silenced and being told that what they think and feel doesn't matter. You may have been told for so many years about the wrongness of your instincts that you have trained yourself to stop listening to them. This is the time to listen again. Get down in your gut and see what it's telling you. Did you know the vagus nerve connects the brain and stomach? We really do, at a literal level, have a second brain in our stomachs. Listen to it. Beyond the gut check, do the spark check. Do you get the little pitter-patter when you brush their arm or during that first kiss? You deserve pitter-patter. Is it no pitter-patter because you were super nervous? Or is it because you really aren't feeling it? It's okay if you're not. Pay attention to that. Someone can be a great person, but not a great person for you. That's okay. Everyone deserves to be chocolate cake. I had a client tell me that his partner of 30-plus years still makes his heart skip a beat. That's amazing. And we all deserve to feel that for someone and be that for someone. If you are dating a person who is amazingly fantastic but doesn't pass the fun check and the spark check, you don't have to keep digging for it. It's okay to think someone is amazing but have zero interest in seeing them naked. The important thing is that you tell them that. I dated my way to a lot of great friendships. It's not an easy conversation, but it doesn't have to be a complicated one. Be honest. Saying something like, "This may sound like bullshit, but I mean every word when I say I think you're amazing and totally deserve someone who thinks you hung the moon, and I'm not going to be that person. I don't want you out of my life, but I respect if me not wanting to date you anymore means you'd rather not see me at all, is better for everyone in the long run, even if it feels awful in the short run. If they get butthurt at your disinclination to sexy times with them and don't want to remain friends, that's okay too. But it's really just fine to offer that as an option if you want to. You also should be aware of your own patterns in this regard. Do you find you always get bored pretty quickly or with genuinely nice people who aren't creating a level of chaos energy that keeps things exciting, but still ultimately toxic? Did all your relationship models function on drama and dysfunction? Do you tend to have three-week stands, then wander off to the next big thing? Chocolate cake doesn't require crazy sprinkles to be yummy. If you are realizing that about yourself, maybe it's time to go back to parts 1 and 2 and do some work on yourself, yeah? Beware the oxytocin trap. Oxytocin is the love drug, the neurochemical best known as whee! Oxytocin is released in physical touch, and yes, especially in orgasms, and it's awesome. But it can also be an asshole. We call it the love drug, but it's really the trust drug. It makes us feel like we can trust the person we are with far more than we likely would otherwise. This is why a salesman will touch your arm when trying to get you to close a deal. This is also why if you go all in on a new relationship, it will burn out fast. If you are with this new person 24/7, you never get a break from the oxytocin flood to actually do a good gut check. Kinda like Kilgrave's hold on his victims in season 1 of Jessica Jones. Make space away from them to see how you feel. Are you halfway relieved when they aren't around? Do you feel better about yourself without them there? Less on guard? Why is that? Do you miss them? What do you actually miss? Are they being shitty about you taking time and space for yourself? Are they pressuring you to be present when you aren't? Does that make you feel controlled? This goes back to the gut check questions. It's important to pay attention to how the trust drug may impact our answers and lead us astray, so you may need to make space for yourself to answer them better. Don't make your friends and family ride your drama llama with you. If you tend to live in the land of one-week stands, that's your decision. Dragging everyone along with you is a pretty dick move, however. Even if you don't have a new person in place on the reg, it's important to live your life, not your new relationship. My general rule of thumb is if you are out with your other people, spend about 25% of your time talking about your new person and 75% of the time talking about all of the rest of your life. It's important to remember that you have one, and it's important not to irritate the fuck out of the people around you. Your new relationship is important too, I get it. But 100% of everything you say important? Nah, 25% is plenty. Are you spending more time talking about the person you were dating than you were spending actually dating them? The people who I've seen working out in the long term are the ones that are out living their lives, not dissecting every move every single minute. What is going on that you feel the need to do a critical incident stress debriefing over every text? Is this something about you that you need to work on, or something about the relationship? If you were feeling so unsettled with this new person that you were having to water cooler quarterback every play, something is up. Maybe with you, if that's your pattern. And if it is, work on that shit. But if you were generally Captain Chill, refer back to rule number 4. Gut check this thing. Consider stepping back a bit on having your friends meet each new person. Give it at least a month. My general rule was 3 to 4 months. And if you have kids, more like 6 months. And if this new person is pressuring you otherwise, ask them and yourself, why? If they aren't going anywhere, then they aren't going anywhere. They don't have to be dumped full force into your life to prove anything. Look for slippage. There is something about that 4-month mark in general, I swear. We can hold ourselves together and show our best sides for about that long tops. Then our authentic self starts leaking out around the edges. Keep an eye out for boo person's real personality to start showing up. This isn't a bad thing. In fact, a lot of idiosyncrasies can be downright adorable, like Friday night pancakes for dinner, or leaving the Sunday paper on the floor because the cat loves to sleep on it. Some things aren't great but are tolerable and are important to know about someone, like low blood sugar hanger, irritability in traffic, that kind of thing. Some things may need to be deeply considered and discussed. Rudeness to waitstaff, disinterest in voting in elections, a deep and abiding love of Nickelback. You know, seriously important, possibly deal-breaking shit. When I asked friends for their dating rules, one said, don't date, interrogate. Another said, talk to one another until dawn at least 3 times. Again, no matter how much you think you know this person's soul after a couple of weeks, you don't. And no matter how much you think they know you, they really, really don't. Oxytocin is a fucking liar. Take the time to have those deep conversations and really get to know someone. Don't give your power away. A friend of mine said, in regard to dating, never treat them like a priority if they only treat you like an option. Another said, want what you want for yourself, love, connection, desire, more than you want any one person. This may seem like 2 separate pieces of advice, but it really isn't. Both people, in their way, are saying, don't give your power away. Anyone you were with should enhance your life, enhance your hopes and dreams, enhance your compassion and engagement with yourself and the world around you. Someone who is not excited about you and about what you bring into the world isn't worth your time. A rejection of you may not have a damn thing to do with you. Now, if all of your relationships end at date number 3, it may be time to figure out what is happening there, either in your behavior or in the people you are choosing. But generally speaking, if you are dating someone and you get a big ol' swipe left, that is far less about you than you realize. Seriously. Someone asked you out? Or been out with maybe a couple times? They don't know you well enough to reject the actual awesomeness that is you. They are rejecting your offer for getting to know the real awesome you. For whatever reason. Maybe their ex called. Maybe they don't like your choice of band t-shirts. Maybe they are oxytocin junkies off in search of their next hit. Maybe they are stupid motherfuckers who don't know a good thing when it is standing right in front of them. But hey, you haven't had the deep getting to know each other conversations for you to take this rejection all kinds of personally. Dating doesn't magically lead to relationshiping. It isn't supposed to. It's supposed to be a tryout period. Next candidate. Have a disclosure plan. I get questions all the time about the timing of important disclosures when dating someone new. There are all kinds of things we may need to disclose to a new dating partner. Things that are not any of the business of other people in our life, but could affect an intimate relationship. That we are unemployed and broke as fuck. That we have kids. That we are poly or into kink. That we have an STI. Information about our gender identity or sexual orientation. Obviously, everyone's situation is unique. And the information you are disclosing can put you at risk with the other person and or anyone they tell. So if you have something big that can affect relationships, it's really important to have a disclosure plan. If your truth bomb conversation runs the risk of ending very badly, have a safety plan. Have the conversation in a public place. Have a friend on standby. Have an escape plan. I can tell you as a rule of thumb, I generally go with lay it all on the table and let people self-select out if it's a problem. Just like I mentioned earlier in the section on how to find a date. If this is presented immediately, then there is less need for big disclosure sessions later. And yes, I totally get that people will self-select out that would have been great partners if they had gotten to know you first. But I am not that invested in developing the emotional maturity of people I don't know and may or may not end up liking. And just looking at the number of trans women of color that are victims of intimate partner violence makes me desperate to encourage all y'all to err on the side of caution and keep yourself safe in the long run. Many of my clients have decided to use dating sites that are specific to their situation for just this reason. There are sites for individuals who have STIs, who are trans, who are poly, who are into BDSM, who are into roleplay. There is legit an app for all the different kinds of ways we can be a human in relationships. And if you can't find one that suits you, you can totally become the next Mark Zuckerberg and create it. Some things on the need to disclose list may have legal consequences if you don't handle it right. For example, knowingly transmitting an STI to a new, uninformed partner could legit get you into legal trouble. I live in Texas, where some STIs could carry the weight of an assault charge and others, namely HIV and AIDS, could find you charged with attempted murder or assault with a deadly weapon. But hey, I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. And listing all the possible laws for each state is a huge undertaking, and it's pretty likely that the laws may change between me writing this and you listening to it. So look them up if you are curious. But legal shit aside, telling people the truth is just the right fucking thing to do. People want to know, so disclose. Before you don't disclose to someone who finds out, freaks out, dumps you, and maybe even presses charges. You are allowed to be crazy. You aren't allowed to act crazy. I have said this so many times, I need to get a tattoo at this point. Whatever nutty things are running through your mind, don't act on it. If you know your past history has messed up your thinking about relationships, then you need to own that that is yours and not foisted upon the people you are dating. Yes, you have baggage. We all do. We are also responsible for carrying our own. Whatever you are feeling isn't right or wrong in the end. Emotions are just info from our body. But if you know that doing something will embarrass you later, do not do the thing. What's the thing? You ask innocently. Different for different people. But we all have a pair of big, striped crazy pants hidden in the backs of our closets. And we all feel the urge to dig them out, put them on, and act all kinds of stupid over relationship issues. It may be driving by their house to see who is parked there, Setting up a fake Facebook account to stalk them. Getting color contacts so your eyes match. Whatever weirdness your brain is telling you is a good idea, don't do it. If you don't want to read about it in the future biography of your life written by Kitty Kelly, don't be stupid. Do not do the thing. Get a friendervention. Hide your phone and car keys from yourself. Don't lash out. Don't be a reactionary. You are responsible for yourself and whatever baggage you still carry, no matter who packed those bags to begin with. Hold yourself accountable. Last bit of dating advice? Be wise. This piece of advice was given to me by Joe McBride. Yes, the Joe McBride of rock and roll high school fame. If you haven't read his memoir, The Broken Places, you really should. If you have, you know he has some intense and dark relationships. So when I asked him what he meant by be wise, he responded, "It's like when Gertrude Stein was dying, and Alice B. Toklas said, 'Gertrude, Gertrude, what is the answer?' Gertrude replied, 'What is the question?'" I know, academics tell the most esoteric jokes. Joe was really saying was be wise in whatever ways make sense for you, your needs, and your relationships. Shift based on what you need to shift. Be aware enough of your own shit to know where you need to be careful. Listen to your instincts. Believe what people show you more than what they tell you. Be thoughtful. Consider all the ways they are communicating with you. People are always telling their stories. Sometimes they even use words. This kind of attention to the world around us is how we be wise. On the glories of not dating, and maybe even still having sex. You don't have to be in one of the ace or demi or gray or aero categories to not be interested in dating. After all, you can have plenty of sex, solo or partnered, without ever dating, right? If you read all the articles online about choosing not to date, they boil down to a few basic reasons. One, you got shit you were actively working on so you can be a good human being in relation to other human beings. Two, you are way too fucking busy with other shit to add more shit to your plate. You can't focus on it, you don't have the time, and you don't want to be dickish to someone else in the process of you finishing school, working crazy hours, raising kids, etc. Three, you just aren't that into it. You're happy and fulfilled, and dating doesn't add anything to the mix for you at this time in your life. All of these reasons are excellent ones. And you are totally entitled to not date to your single love and heart's content. You may notice that your level of sexual satisfaction is not as good with partners you don't have an emotional attachment to. Research says that's generally the case. But hey, if you are not dating because of anxieties or other reasons, when the truth is you really, really actually want to date, it isn't the worst idea in the world to unpack what's holding you back. Therapy can help with that. You deserve to be happy, and if dating will help you get there, let's figure that shit out. And not dating but still wanting some partnered sex game? Also totally fine. Despite how progressive culture has gotten in so many ways, we still manage to get our prude on about no-string sex. And there is zero wrong with having an FWB or pickups and hookups, and if that is what works for you, go for it. As long as everyone is on the same page about the plan. It should probably go without saying that you need to be careful about prevention, STIs, and unwanted pregnancies and the like. But you're a responsible person and you know that, right? The biggest issue I see happen is someone in the hookup relationship catches feelings. And that happens. It's not a bad thing or an embarrassing thing. But it is something that needs to be discussed and dealt with, which goes back to the full disclosure dialogue. Not a fun conversation, but a needful one. Even just, "I know this is supposed to be low-key, but lately I've been wanting it to be more. If you do too, that would be amazing and we should talk about that. If not, I probably need to not see you since it's gonna mess with my head and I don't wanna go all crazy on the both of us. No matter what your circumstances, keep it honest and watch for your own motivations and reactions. You won't always do everything perfectly, but you are far less likely to be blindsided that way. Relationshipping. Relationshipping is not dating. And thank Buddha, because even if you were going in with the healthiest attitude ever, dating can be really tiring. Especially if you are adulting up a storm and you still seem to have a bat signal for the crazy. Of course, getting booed up has its own set of crap to navigate. In some ways, you are safer and more secure, and you don't have to worry so much anymore. But on the other side, I see folks feeling too safe and secure and unworried, and then fuck things up, all old-school pitfall style. And I don't want that for you. You've been working too hard on all this shit to biff out now. Whether you and your partner are still all new and shiny, or whether you have years under your belt, actively working on your relationship in the small ways will make the larger obstacles far more easier to deal with, and may end up preventing them altogether. Love people, not labels. Whether the label is boy or girl, neurosurgeon or flight attendant, labels are assignments we attach to aspects of our being, and they are not the sum entirety of who we are. And they change. They change all the time. So if you become attached to the label that someone wears, you are going to be sadly disappointed when that label falls off. The strongest couples I see are the ones that go through enormous changes together. In physical ability, career, socioeconomic status, even gender presentation and attribution. How do you marry someone you thought was a man and was male assigned at birth? Be in their process of realizing they are a woman? Stay with them through all their gender confirmation treatments and surgeries, even if your sexual orientation never included women? Loving that person like a motherfucking boss, that's how. I had a friend approached at work a few years back by a well-meaning and awkward colleague who asked her, "What do you prefer? Black? African American? I want to use the language that you are most comfortable with." My friend's response was perfect. Brightly, she replied, "How about just Evelyn?" The only label your partner should ever get from you? Mine. Grow together instead of apart. Along with this goes the idea that these changes work best in togetherness and with each other's support. When long-term relationships start to fall apart over longer periods of time, it's often because partners don't remain connected in their growth. People change all the time. Life changes us, maturity changes us, and our circumstances put us in places we never thought we'd be. Your partner may have interests that are wildly different from your own, or interests that you never expected. Unless we are with people that are doing something that harms themselves or others, they deserve support in their journey. Be your partner's biggest cheerleader and expect them to be yours. My partner and I are both writers, so that's the easy part. We both mutter to ourselves and spend too much money on books. We also do other things that are wildly different from each other and from the mainstream. We don't spend every waking moment invested in our differences. We are both off doing our things on a regular basis. Holding hands all the time while wearing matching tracksuits is creepy-ass shit. But we do stay involved in each other's interests. We ask questions and cheerlead. We support as much as possible. My closet became wardrobe for the low-budget movie he is shooting. And be excited for each other's successes. I recently overheard him chatting with his dad, saying, "Faith has been traveling the state doing things I don't fully understand, but she's super excited, and I'm going with her next week to Austin when I'm off to watch her work." No matter how apart our interests are, we stay in each other's orbit. Knowing that the person you choose to spend your life with is right behind you, keeping an eye on your six for you, is the best feeling in the world. Everybody deserves to be chocolate cake. The first most important thing in the world is for your partner to be batshit crazy about you. The second most important thing is to be batshit crazy about them. I have seen so many people in long-term relationships struggling because they love their partner but aren't in love with their partner. They have become family. They are comfortable together. They are both amazing people, but they are dying slowly on the inside. Everyone deserves to be chocolate cake, to be with someone that absolutely delights in being there, who craves them, who thanks their lucky stars that this person chose them back. Staying with someone because they want you to is not doing them any favors, never mind you. We all deserve a partner who looks at us like we are the most amazing and delicious thing they could imagine. Everyone deserves to go through their day knowing that they are their partner's first and only choice every moment of their lives. Don't kick the puppy. Along with that, don't allow yourself bad behavior even if your partner does. If you kick a puppy, it may come back and lick your hand over and over again, but that is not an excuse to keep kicking. If you know your actions are hurting your partner at some level, you have to stop. Even if they say it's okay. Even if they are not brave or strong enough to ask you to stop. Have some self-accountability. Stop the behavior or get out of the relationship. This seems to happen in relationships where one partner is not chocolate cake. You know what I mean. If one partner has all the power in the relationship because their mate is slavishly devotional in keeping them happy and keeping them there, a lot of metaphorical puppy kicking takes place. Taking advantage of their desperation to keep you. Blowing them off at the last minute, accepting gifts and favors, messing around when they didn't agree to polyamory. Generally being rude and disrespectful. Just because someone lets you treat them like that does not mean it's okay. You've heard of the golden rule, right? Even better, the platinum rule. Treat others the way they want to be treated. If you can't do that for your partner, or you don't want to, you need to move on. Don't take advantage of them allowing your bad behavior. Don't fucking lie. Don't half-truth. Don't omit. Don't answer on a technical truth, Captain Semantics. Own your shit. Be honest and be authentic. Own it as yours, but say it. If you are angry, say you were angry. Take responsibility and say why. Ask for something different and hope you will get it. But don't say you are okay when you are not. And for fuck's sake, don't play a semantics game in your mind. Don't be sneaky. Don't be sketch. Don't rationalize. If your partner would be hurt or upset by anything they saw in your phone or on your computer, don't fucking do it. If you feel the need to hide it, you are absolutely cheating at some level. So the question is then, what if I have a partner who is batshit crazy and jealous and doesn't want me doing or being or saying anything to anyone ever? Why is that? Is it something you did in the past? If you violated trust, then you do owe your partner the margins of suspicion and distrust. You broke the bond and are the one that is going to have to bend over backwards to make it right. If you aren't the problem, if this comes from their past history, support them in doing the work they need to do to get better, whether it be therapy or some other form of support. It isn't that they mistrust you. It's that they mistrust themselves in choosing safe people to love. They are expecting you to hurt them and are looking for evidence that this is the case. But the original statement holds. If you could hold up your phone and say, show your partner that yes, you got a text from Jess, and the nature of the text was, do you want donuts or breakfast tacos at tomorrow's meeting? And there is no back history with Jess or anyone else, then this is about them. Not about you. Everyone has the right to feel safe. We have the right to physical safety and emotional safety. Physical safety doesn't just mean free from interpersonal violence, it means feeling in control of your personal body at all times. I've worked with people who have never laid a hand on their partner, but they have a way of dominating with their physical presence that feels threatening and intimidating. It was an intentional way of controlling the other person, and while it wasn't physical violence, it wasn't safe, and it was not acceptable. Emotional safety can be equally hard to define. Maybe it's like porn, and we know it when we see it. But I ask people to describe the sensations in their body when they feel a sense of safety. Not just their thoughts and feelings, but how they settle into themselves. Like how we feel when we crawl into a comfortable bed with soft sheets at the end of a long day. The people in our lives should support that feeling inside us, and we should do the same for them whenever we can. Be fucking happy, and be happy fucking. If the sex is good, it's 10% of the relationship. If it's bad, it becomes 90%. If it's going along swimmingly, it makes everything else work better. It's the glitter glue that helps hold the relationship together. It's just as necessary as the rest of the foundational supports, and sex is so many different things. Having a healthy sex life doesn't imply just penetrative intercourse. It's whatever works best for you and your partner. Are y'all having those conversations? I know most of us weren't raised to do that, but hell, if we can't talk to our partners about this shit, then who can we talk to? This is where we go back to the relationship being its own entity that needs attending to. You may need to ask for what you want, to listen to what your partner wants. You may need to go back to some reconnection basics. Maybe a checklist of stuff you want to try that you both fill out and share with each other to see what might be on the menu. But find what works, and make that an integral part of the relationship. Love is a behavior, not a feeling. Love is not a nebulous idea. It's not a vague notion of warm and fuzzies. It's the real daily interactions of sharing our lives with someone, caring for them, and having them care for us in return. Love is what we do day in, day out, not what we profess in our status updates. Love is stopping what you are doing to sit with your mate and talk about their bad day. It's making sure they have avocados in the fridge for their favorite snack. Love is making time for date night even when you've been together for years and decades. Love is sending a text saying, "I was just thinking about you. How's your day? Love you." It's living our lives with this person at our side at all times, even if they aren't physically present. Put each other before anything or anyone else. And then, together as a team, go tackle the world. Losing sight of our partner as our primary person in this world most often happens when we have children. But other things can cause this to be an issue as well. Careers, other family, friends. Have you heard the term yoke before? It's an old-fashioned word used to describe the crossbeam that was used to connect two farm animals together so they could effectively pull a plow. And no, I'm not calling you an ox or a cow. It became a term to later explain marriage, because the idea is that two equal partners, organized to work together, effectively accomplish way more than two separated individuals. We work harder, stronger, and more effectively as a yoked team. If you have kids, you put each other first, and then as a team, put the children first, or whatever else you are tackling. You and your partner must come first to each other. To keep from flying off in different directions, working toward different ends, etc. Stay yoked. Fuck all the rules. All the ideas, all the guidelines, all of them. Even these ones if they don't fit. I mean, I can't see why. I think they're excellent. But you know what? You and your partner need to make your own map. Hell, maybe even partner isn't the right word. Maybe you are polyamorous and partners is the better word. You do you. If you and your partner are delighted with the course you have charted, keep staying true. Keep the dialogue open, make corrections as needed, and love each other silly. Communication to prevent conflict and skills to resolve conflict. So many of our relationship fights could have been headed off at the pass if we had communicated proactively to begin with. I know I've been guilty of nurturing a world of butthurt that would have been easily headed off if I had just used my words. Unless you are a total specimen of perfection, you've probably done the same at some point. Changing how we engage can make all the difference in the world. And if the fight happens anyway, we got skills for that too. Communicating like a grown person. This doesn't mean bitching at Boo more. It means bitching at, communicating with Boo differently. Do you remember the Pythagorean theorem? You totally just recited A squared plus B squared equals C squared in your head, didn't you? Did you ever use that out of school? Yeah, me neither. You know what would have been way more helpful to learn? How to communicate with I statements. Try this with your partner when you were all kinds of hacked off, or all kinds of thrilled for that matter. I feel blank when you blank. What I want is blank. You know what this is? Being a grown-ass person who takes responsibility for their own feelings and actions and clearly communicates their needs, rather than blaming Boo, you made me mad, or doing the freeze-out, no-talking thing. If you really loved me, you would read my mind. It's gonna feel all kinds of weird and awkward at first. I've had lots of people tell me that they bust out laughing the first few times they try it. It's just so unnatural, isn't it? Because we don't encourage people to talk like this, taking accountability and responsibility for their feelings. But we should. Our feelings are completely our own, and we shouldn't blame others for them. We can, however, ask them for different behaviors because their behaviors disrespect our boundaries and cause negative feelings. This skill works in regular communication and stays in place even if your convo has leveled up to conflict level. Staying with ownership of your own feelings completely shifts away from the blame game. You can even take an extra step in acknowledging that they didn't intend the distress you felt by adding that to the statement, such as, "I felt uncomfortable when you made that joke just now. I know you just meant it to be funny and thought I would laugh rather than be upset, but I struggle with jokes about that topic. I would really appreciate it if you didn't tell jokes like that around me." That's awesome shit right there. And bonus points on this, Boo can't tell you how to feel if you were taking ownership of it. It's not right or wrong, it's just what you feel. Adulting for the win. The four levels of communication. We are all trying to communicate Mo better. The communicating with I statements model I use earlier in this book is a great strategy for being more mindful of that process. But figuring out where the breakdowns come from the most often is also hugely beneficial. I first heard this model in an online course I was streaming on neurolinguistic programming. I can't find reference to it anywhere, so I don't know the origin story. And if you do, please drop me a line. Discussing an idea without the appropriate citation and attribution upsets my little academic heart, but the ideas here are too brilliant to not share. The basic idea is each exchange of verbal dialogue has four levels. 1. What we mean to say. You know, the actual idea you were trying to express. 2. What we actually say. If you are really good at only saying exactly what you mean at all times, you are a rock star, and I hope you write a book on your technique. For us regular humans, what we have in our minds and what comes out of our mouths is not always a solid match. 3. What the other person hears. Because just because you said it doesn't mean they heard it without any filter. 4. What the other person thinks you mean. Even if you said, "Anything for dinner is fine," and you meant anything for dinner is fine, your partner may think there is a hidden agenda or other things going on beyond the words that actually came out of your mouth.